Okay, we are we've just been finished talking about Onken's church and the impact it had, how the building was destroyed by Allied bombing. And unfortunately, when you bomb an area, you can't, at least you can't now, completely pick and choose, and you couldn't at all in those days, and the records of it, and that many of the pastors in the churches in Germany. And I know what the next point I was going to make was this. You don't really hear much about underground churches in Germany. That's because they were mostly devastated. The above ground churches were devastated during Hitler's reign. When the communists come into Eastern Europe, they take control gradually. It's not all at once. And so, seeing what's happening, and the thing you have to do to become an underground church is abandon your building. As long as you have a building, you're caught. But as the communists took over gradually, a lot of the believers abandoned their church buildings and began to meet in the forests and in living rooms and so forth. And I know a number of underground pastors in Syria, and the normal thing for them to do is have church in their living room. They're not going to have very many people, but little churches all over the place. So all over Eastern Europe, and you get reports and pieces of it during the Iron Curtain era. There were churches all over the place. But your information about them was very limited. When the Iron Curtain fell and they could come back out in the open, that was a totally different set of circumstances. And you begin to find out who was where and what was happening. And I think a lot of folks have been amazed how many underground churches there were, how much that went on, what all God did. And I suspect there's probably lots and lots that we don't know yet. Roman numeral 6, Scandinavia. In 1843, two Swedish seamen became acquainted with Baptists in New York City. In other words, they were in a Swedish merchant ships. But the merchant ships would often stop in New York City and sometimes be there 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. Okay? Well, they became acquainted with some Baptists during that time, during times of stopping there. One presented himself for believer's baptism and ended up staying in the United States. The other, his first initials is all I have, F.O. Nilsson, N-I-L-S-O-N, returned to Sweden and eventually went to Onken's church in Hamburg for further study. He eventually presented himself for believer's baptism and became a missionary to Sweden. Became a missionary to Sweden. After 3 years, Nilsson was banished from Sweden. He then pastored for 2 years in Denmark. Then he led a group of Swedish Baptists to the United States where they could have religious freedom. This is the beginning of what's called the Swedish Baptists in the United States. And this may come amazing, and they no longer use the name Swedish Baptist. They did when I was first in the ministry. There are hundreds of Swedish Baptists in the churches in the United States. They come from this moment where some Baptists in New York City are witnessing to two Swedish sailors. I doubt seriously they had any idea what was coming as a result of all that. But you ended up having hundreds of Swedish Baptist churches. No longer are they ethnic. No longer do they have services in Swedish. Or are they just for people from Sweden in background? And no longer are they the force for the Lord they once were. Modernism having entered there, it hasn't completely taken them yet. But it has entered, and they're in that state where modernism has started and is growing. But not every Swedish Baptist church is modernist. And we have one in Chicago that preaches the gospel to some extent, preaches the gospel, but you see modernism coming around on the edges, and some of their folks come, they only have a Sunday morning service, some of their folks come to Ravenswood on Sunday night, and we just had a gentleman from there join our church because he's concerned about, you know, encroaching modernism. So they're still in that state. But this starts in 1843, okay? For over 100 years, there are eventually hundreds of Swedish Baptist churches. They have a college, they have a seminary. And for a while, they're really an undiluted force for the Lord. You never know who you're witnessing to. You never know who you're talking to. You never know what comes out of that. And that name today seems strange to people, which is why they've recently changed it, and I forget what they've changed it to. But you would see, I said Swedish Baptist Church. So what's a Swedish Baptist Church? And they long ago quit having church services in the Swedish language. But so many Swedish Baptists came to the United States in the 1800s looking for religious freedom. They formed their own churches, and they were still all over the country. And for probably 100 years, were an undiluted force for the Lord. And you still find some Swedish Baptist churches that are basically doctrinally sound. Now, frankly, as long as they stay in that group, it's going to continue to eat away at them. Anyway, after 7 years, he was allowed to return to Sweden, and he began a Baptist church in Gothenburg. Missionary pastors from Hamburg began a church in Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. By 1861, there were 125 reported Baptist churches in Sweden. Government persecutions gradually faded in Sweden, and Baptists became the largest of the non-Lutheran groups in Sweden. By far and large, Lutheranism is, you know, the dominant religion in Sweden. But the second largest, though much, much smaller, group is Baptists. And the early persecution of Baptists had faded. Persecution was no longer their problem. So anybody want to take a guess what happened to them? Modernism. The devil doesn't get you from this side. He comes at you from this side. But he never gives up. I've said the only admirable thing about the devil is his persistence. We could learn something from that. The devil never looks at a moment. He tries something. He never looks at a moment and then says, well, I'm beaten. I can't do anything now. If this didn't work, he just comes back at it with this. You look at the history of the church I pastor 123 years. Started as a German language Baptist church, because the community was largely German. The early sermons, the early church records, everything are in German for about 20 years. It starts in, I think it's 1888. 1934, they're having a battle over modernism. Okay? There's a man there named Pastor Farrington who's wise. He sees the battle over modernism. He spends a year preaching against modernism. And this has a come to grips meeting. And they vote a third of the church members out of the church. The modernist third. And I tell our folks, I tell you, here we are, 2014. The church has the exact same doctrinal statement it had then in 1934. We preach from the same Bible. We preach the same gospel. That is all because Pastor Farrington and two-thirds of the congregation took a stand in 1934. But that doesn't mean the devil never fought it after that. They actually called, and I don't know how this happened, you go through the history, they called the number two man in a false cult to come be their pastor at one point in the 40s. Don't ask me, I can't even imagine how that happened. Okay. But he only lasted a couple years. And there's nothing in the records about his leaving, but I'm assuming after him being there 2 years, folks had figured out what he was all about, and they got rid of him. Devil never quits coming. Never quits coming. Different angles, different ways. Before I came as a pastor, there's a man been there a number of years. And both of his son-in-laws wanted to go the contemporary church route. And there are brief moments of his son-in-laws, one of them being co-pastor, the other being pastor, trying to take the church, the contemporary church route. And the church people refused to go. As a great credit to them, they did not make the mistake that so many churches had. But the devil never stops trying to come. Never. And we have one of the sweetest spirited churches you'd ever be around with the same doctrinal statement it had, exact same doctrinal statement it had in 1934. And things are very comfortable there. But I'm not blind. That doesn't mean the devil's not mounting another challenge. I don't know what direction he's coming from. So based on knowing something about church history, what should I do? Well, you steer clear of things to be a problem. You got to be ready, since you don't know what direction it's coming from. You have to be on your guard all the time, every way, every direction. Right now, our people are so sweet-spirited, we're so doctrinally sound, and it's a wonderful thing. That doesn't mean we fought our last battle. That devil doesn't say, oh, Ravenswood's doing well, I quit. He doesn't do that with any place. So since we don't know what the next battle is, we have to be prepared for anything. It's actually easier if you know what the next battle is, because you can focus on it. And again, let me use this illustration, talking about what happened in the Eastern European countries when the churches went underground. Okay? If you ever came to a point in the United States where there was serious persecution, what kind of churches would they go after first? Independent Baptist, but I mean even among Independent Baptists. Churches like Quinton Road that influenced a lot of people. That's who they have to go. They can't leave a church with a television ministry if they're ever going to do much persecution. And they train preachers, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, you can't even comprehend trying to transition Quinton Road from where it's at now to being underground. I mean, it's just, you can't even comprehend that. And probably wouldn't need to worry about it, because it's the kind of church they would go after first. But if that kind of thing ever happens and they start going after the Quinton Roads that are very visible, other churches would have time to make a transition. And some would never do it, because some people would never give up their building. To them, the building is the church, and they'd never give it up. Don't worry, they'll come take it from you. I mean, that problem will solve itself eventually. But God help us never to go through that, but you can't even imagine what these folks went through as they tried to transition from being above-ground churches to underground churches. That's completely foreign to us, because we've been so blessed with religious liberty throughout our existence as a country. We haven't thought about it, haven't taught about it, prepared it. There was never a time when our churches were underground that we're going to. So it's completely foreign to us. There are other countries where that's not foreign at all. I preached in India 3 years ago, and in Manipur. And the laws are different in every province of India. Manipur is Hindu-dominated, and churches are persecuted, no doubt about it. And various things. One Sunday, I preached in 4 different churches, and at 2 of them, there were people outside taking down the names of the people they saw going to the church services. But one of the churches there had come up with a very interesting solution. It's in a Hindu village. And various groups in Hindu village would sponsor banks, but then they'd steal from everybody that wasn't in their group. So they ended up going to the Baptist church and let the Baptist church hold everybody's money, because they believed the Baptists wouldn't steal from them. So because the Baptist church is the bank for the community, it's left alone. And that's sort of the deal they have. We keep everybody's money. We keep an honest accounting. In exchange, you don't bother us. So nobody's there writing down the names of that people. But this is the thing that fascinates me. They'd previously had local ordinances against Baptists. But when they finally had to trust somebody with the community's money, you know who they trusted? Not any of their Hindu groups. They trusted a Baptist. And of course, and that pastor, I'm sure, is wise enough to know this. The church ever takes anybody's money, they're had. I mean, they won't get the same tolerance that others did. But because they are virtually the bank keepers for that city, they now are able to worship openly and function openly without any persecution for now. One of the great things I'd be concerned about if I was them would be about being falsely accused of mishandling money. But for now, it's working. Well, in 1860, a Baptist church was organized by Frederick L. Reimker in Norway. It was originally composed of 7 members. Reimker was a Danish sailor who had been saved and baptized while in the United States. Again, you never know about the person you just reached. In 1877, there were 14 Baptist churches in Norway. The number of Baptist churches in Norway has never been large, but the numbers continued to grow until the present. In 1839, a Baptist church was organized in Copenhagen, Denmark, from people who had been won to Christ during the mission from Anken's church in Hamburg. You notice how they keep coming up over and over again, country after country? Its pastor was imprisoned. His place was taken by his brother, who was also in prison. Persecution continued into 1850 when religious liberty was granted in Denmark. Baptist growth in Denmark remained limited. Again, you could go on and on with country after country in Europe, and in, to the degree you have records, Anken's church just makes an impact on Europe that is hard to compare to any other church. I am not aware of any church that has influenced as much foreign missions as Anken's church did. It's an incredible story. The church itself doesn't exist today. But his vision for starting churches all over Europe was captured by his congregation, and they supported the training and the support of the starting, and God just used them in incredible fashion.